Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Squawker Talker podcast. And as always, here on the pod, we have scoured the footballing world to give you our hot take on one of the biggest football talking points doing the rounds right now. And with that in mind, we are taking an alternative look into the rise of Portugal and Portuguese stars in Premier League football so far this season. And all of this comes ahead of what I'm calling the mini Portugal derby this weekend. But it's not in the Algarve, it's not in a beautiful Lisbon, it's going to be in the Mancunian rain. Defending champions Manchester City play host to their Portuguese neighbours, Wolves. So that's going to be the big one for this weekend. But alongside that, we'll also be assessing the overall impact of these Portuguese superstars on the Premier League and asking the all-important question, who is the best Portuguese player currently plying their trade in the English top flight? And to be honest, we've got absolutely stacks and stacks of players to choose from. Cristiano Ronaldo's gold-filled return to Manchester United has reminded English football fans of just how good he is. Whilst, with the exception of the Egyptian king of Anfield, the Premier League has been dominated by two other stars so far this season. Bernardo Silva for City and Diogo Jota, Salah's teammate at Liverpool. And if all of that isn't enough Portuguese talent to keep you going, there's also the human Swiss Army knife that is João Cancelo and the reigning PFA Player of the Year, Ruben Diaz, and obviously plenty, plenty more. Right then, let's get started. My name's Fergal Brennan, and joining me as ever on the podcast, we have Squawker's chief football writer, Mohamed Butt. Now, Mo, apologies, there's going to be no Pepe in this podcast. It's not going to be a Pepe cast, but I'm sure you'll still have plenty to get stuck into. How are you doing?
Well, I'm very upset there's no Pepe in this podcast. I might actually leave now, and you two can just do it yourself, because with no Pepe, there's no Mo.
No Pepe, no Mo, no Pepe, no party. I think that's fair enough. And alongside Mo, lending us an expert view on Pepe, on Portugal, on Portuguese football, we have Tom Kundert from Portugal and also the Portugal correspondent for World Soccer magazine. Tom, how's things?
Yeah, fine, thanks. Thanks for having me on. You know, always pleased to waffle away about Portuguese footballers, and especially when they're doing so, you know, so fantastically well in the world's most high-profile league.
Indeed, indeed. Well, waffle, waffle, waffle all you like. Right, we're going to start off with the man himself, the man who wears number 7 at Mo's Manchester United, Cristiano Ronaldo, the big story of the summer, Tom, coming back to the Premier League after over a decade away, started his career in English football with Manchester United, and this is seen as a kind of bookending of his career, certainly in European football, comes back to Manchester United. There's huge amounts of attention on what is expected from him, what he's going to do, what sort of an impact he's going to have. And there's been a lot of polarisation around Ronaldo's return and what he's achieved and what might have been expected from him. But job number one for Cristiano Ronaldo was to come back to Manchester United and score important goals. And he's done exactly that. 12 goals in all competitions, 6 in the Premier League and 6 in the Champions League. And he's, I'm sure Mo won't mind me saying, he's pretty much single-handedly dragged United into the last 16 of the Champions League. So with all that in mind, there is always going to be questions over other areas of his game. Has Ronaldo met the objectives that were expected from him when he decided to return to Manchester United?
Yeah, I think so. In my opinion, I'm going to be very interested to hear Mo, who obviously watches them much more closely than me. But, you know, just looking at the numbers, I think I find it quite astonishing in some ways that Cristiano Ronaldo is questioned to such a degree that he is. You know, lots of suggestions that seem to be basically saying that he's made Manchester United a worse team. And I really can't get my head around that at all, because I, you know, call me old fashioned, but I think the most important stat, much more important than how much a player, you know, presses the opponents, is basically, you know, how many goals they score. And I can't understand how bringing in a player which guarantees you 30 plus goals a season will fail to make you a stronger team. So, and like you said, you know, he's come in. Manchester United haven't been playing well at all this season. And yet, you know, he's been scoring goals like he would do if the team were thriving. And like you just said, basically single-handedly getting them into the, you know, the knockout stages of the Champions League. So, yeah, you know, he's doing what Cristiano Ronaldo does, which is score goals. Obviously, he's not the same player as he was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, much less, of course, the sort of player he was when he first rocked up at Old Trafford. Completely different sort of player. But I think the whole question about that Manchester United have to solve, and they were plainly unable to solve it with, you know, Solskjaer, is how to set up the team to get the best out of Cristiano Ronaldo, to get the best out of them. Because if you do that, you've got 35 goals there. I always remember a quote from Ancelotti when he was at Real Madrid, and he had Cristiano Ronaldo scoring literally, you know, 50 goals a season, 60 goals a season. And he just said, listen, with Cristiano Ronaldo in the side, basically you start every game 1-0 up. So, you know, that's how important he is to this side. And, you know, maybe not quite at that level now, but I think, you know, basically United, if they have Cristiano Ronaldo in the side, can maybe start 2 out of every 3 games, 1 goal up.
When you look at the situation with Ronaldo, Mo, there is so many variables to throw into the pot in terms of the performances that he's turned in, the goals that he's scored, and the impact that he has. And this polarisation in the debate amongst United fans and amongst Premier League fans in general over he does this, but he doesn't do this. He scores these goals, but he doesn't do this for the team or this for the system, X, Y, and Z. Ultimately, to kind of make a decision on how he's impacted on Manchester United since he's come back, you need to throw all of that in and come out with an answer. You're a Manchester United fan. He has scored all these goals. They are through to the Champions League last 16. They're still definitely within more than a fighting chance of getting into the top four in the Premier League. But the numbers do only tell a portion of the story of Cristiano Ronaldo back at Manchester United.
It's a very... Look, this is Cristiano 5 years ago. Wait, when was 2018? Okay, 6 years ago was utterly magnificent. Probably the last truly, truly great Cristiano season where he was not just a goal scorer, but he was a dynamic all-around threat. 2016-17, absolutely incredible season. Maybe you could argue 17-18 as well was similar, but he got older. As he got older, and what was brilliant, what he did was quite brilliant, was he adjusted his game to compensate. Okay, I can't dribble as much as I used to anymore. Although he still skipped around Bram Whitaker training going against Arsenal. That I thought was incredible. That's probably the best thing he's done at United, honestly. He's, you know, he can't dribble anymore, can't run as much anymore. So what can I do? So he focuses more on, he drifts around trying to find space, doesn't really do it efficiently or anything, but he makes sure that he doesn't expend too much energy until the last 10 meters of the pitch when he springs to life, gets in there and just sniffs out chances, because that's what he's great at, because he's an amazing goal scorer, probably top three goal scorer of all time. You know, certainly top five, you know, he's incredible. 800 career goals. 801, even, sorry. You know, he's incredible at scoring goals. So, yeah, you know, it's the debate. You know, the whole thing, does he press, does he not press? That's really a misnomer, because honestly, until Ranić arrived, which was literally just a week ago, United didn't press. United were not a pressing side under Solskjaer. Solskjaer, in fact, was very much almost anti-press, to the point where he would either have two modes of play. One was just go out and try, give it a go, gung-ho sort of thing. And the other was sit back and hit on the break, you know, very Fergie style, you know. He didn't used to press. He didn't really, wasn't a pressing team. But the counter-attacking thing is where I think Cristiano hasn't made United a worse team, in the sense that we don't know what United would have been without him, right? But it was obvious United were assembling something. This is the thing with Ronaldo, is you can't, it's hypothetical versus what actually is, right? So you could see United were building something. They wanted Cavani to mentor Greenwood as a striker. They bought Jadon Sancho, they're chasing for years, to play right wing. Rashford was going to play left wing. And then you're going to have Bruno Fernandes in the middle of the park. And it was going to be, everything was going to be all this movement and pace around Bruno. And he'd been the best player in the Premier League from his debut up to the start of this season. Up to the 3 games into this season, he was the best player in the Premier League in that time, above everyone else. And the idea was clear, okay, let's augment him with Jadon Sancho, who's a creative player, going to take the burden off him creatively, link with him well, movement of Greenwood, movement of Rashford, whatever, right? That was the plan. Clearly, that was the plan. They chased Sancho for 2 years. Then you sign Cristiano Ronaldo, ostensibly because you don't want Man City to sign him, but whatever, you sign him. And that just disrupts everything in terms of that plan, right? Because you have to put him in the team. He can't run like any of those other players can run, not even Cavani. He can't move like Cavani can. He can score goals like none of them can. None of them can score goals like him. So it's a trade-off, right? You lose the ability to counter-attack. You lose the ability to play at pace, to rip through teams like United did under Solskjaer repeatedly in big games, where they'd sit deep, absorb pressure, and then just hit them on the break. They couldn't do that anymore because you have to play to Ronaldo's strength, which is getting him balls in the box, right? So you can't play a coherent style of football. So you don't play coherent football. So you play kind of rubbish football. And occasionally, you manage to give the guy a half-decent ball in the box, Cristiano, because he's so good at goal scoring. He scores goals. He saves United. Like, Champions League is a great example. He didn't play well in a single one of those games, by the way, in the Champions League. But he scored six goals. And not just six goals. All of them were either equalisers or go-ahead goals or game winners. You know, so he's changing the game state every time he scores a goal. He's amazing at scoring goals. And that's what I'm saying. It's the theoretical versus the actual. The actual fact of Cristiano at Man United is he scored loads of goals, right? You can't argue with that. He's scored loads of goals. He's influenced almost every goal he scored has been important. He hasn't scored any stat paddy ones like he used to do at Real Madrid to get his 60 goals a season. He's been changing the game state every single goal. It's really efficient, really impressive, game-changing stuff. But on the other hand, it has prevented, I mean, until Rangnick, obviously, we have to wait and see how he evolves under Ralf Rangnick. So far, I mean, the one game he played so far, he did seem to be more in tune with and more willing to work with what Rangnick wanted the team to do. So fair play, you have to say. But previously to Rangnick arriving, he did disrupt the way United could play as a team, cohesively, coherently. And United didn't play, as a result, didn't play cohesively and coherently. And part of that is on Solskjaer not being a strong enough coach to rein Ronaldo in and say, look, dude, you're great in the box, stay in the box, we'll let everyone else take care of everything else. You know, that's partly on Solskjaer, right? But it's also, that's one of the problems you have with Cristiano when he comes along. He demands a very strong coach with a very clear idea of how to use him, right? He sought off, I think, what, five coaches now? Allegri couldn't handle him. Sarri couldn't handle him. Pirlo couldn't handle him. Solskjaer couldn't handle him. But you look at how Zidane handled him. Ancelotti, they handled him perfectly. Now, okay, he was a better player than true, but they understood how to use him and how to make him effective. These other guys didn't really. And, you know, Solskjaer, you could argue, I'm sorry, and finally, just one last thing. You can argue, one thing in Solskjaer's defence is Ancelotti and Zidane had Benzema, who augmented Cristiano, right? Fernando Santos doesn't have Benzema. We'll get on to Portugal later. And United's Benzema is an injury-prone 34-year-old. So maybe that's a problem. Maybe that's part of why United haven't been able to play cohesively and coherently with Ronaldo on the side, is they don't have a Benzema or a Wayne Rooney when he was last at United, a selfless kind of striker that's going to be a number nine, make runs and let Ronaldo run to goal scoring positions. I don't know. Who's to say? But he's been a success, but it's a qualified success. That's what you have to say about Ronaldo at Man United. It's a qualified success. He's scored goals. He's disrupted possible team play. Where does the balance fall out? I mean, as long as he keeps scoring goals, it's okay. You know, solving the problems he creates. Yeah, jobs are good, I guess.
Tom, before we move on to Silva and Jota, I just wanted to ask you, in terms of the perception within Portugal of Ronaldo's return to Manchester United, so much has been focused around him at United and the goals and the performances. And as Mo rightly said, it is a big debate in the Premier League, which, as you touched on before, sounds crazy because the job he was brought back to do was to score goals, and he has scored goals, and United are generally achieving most of their objectives so far this season. So I wanted to ask you, obviously, the fallout from Juventus last summer, there was big links that it was Manchester City that he was going to, not Manchester United. A little bit of drama, 11th hour intervention from Sir Alex Ferguson, and ultimately he goes back to United, the fairy tale, etc. What's been the perception in Portugal in terms of that being the sensible or the right move, given the fact that City was an option, which would have meant a title challenge and potentially a Champions League challenge? Is it seen as it was the right move to go back to Manchester United, or is it seen as just a bit of a nostalgic push from both club and player?
No, I think it was seen as the right move, without a doubt. You know, Portuguese people there, it's quite amazing, really, how Cristiano Ronaldo, what he has done for Portugal, just in terms of perception of the country itself. You know, you go anywhere in the world, you say that you're Portuguese or you live in Portugal, what's the first thing people think about? Cristiano Ronaldo. You know, he is just such a national hero, and lots of people became huge Cristiano Ronaldo fans, of course, but Manchester United fans when he went there, because of course that's when he first kind of morphed from this incredibly exciting young winger to just a world-class talent and someone who was, you know, destined to be one of the greats of the game. And people in Portugal don't forget that. You know, that was a source of pride for Portugal and for Portuguese people, a huge source of pride. And so they were, you know, very happy for him to go there. I think just to, like you say, it was a bit of a nostalgia, I suppose, to, you know, looking back at that time, which was a special time for him and for fans of Portuguese football. But, you know, a real sense that he could replicate that, you know, his success, because basically Ronaldo has spent, I'd say, probably the last 7-8 years basically proving everyone who says that he's not the player he was anymore, proving those people wrong, you know, and saying when he went to Italy, a lot of people said it was the wrong move. He, you know, he wouldn't be able to score so many goals there. You know, he just basically no let up in his scoring rate, just scoring goals galore. You know, people say it all the time. He's not the same player he was. It was interesting what Mo said there earlier. I agree with him wholeheartedly. One of the, I'd say one of the big assets or one of the big qualities of Cristiano Ronaldo, which is a little bit underrated, is his intelligence, his football intelligence. You know, he's changed. He's thought about how he can continue to make the most out of his talents. He's changed his game so that he does still become, he still is an incredibly effective footballer, doing, you know, scoring goals, obviously in a different way than he used to.
What's so funny is if he moved to City, that would have been so much smarter for his career, because when you look at what City are and what they're missing, and it's literally just someone to appear in the box and tap the ball home repeatedly over and over again, every single game. He would, I mean, you know, he might well score 30 goals for Man United. He would absolutely almost clock 50, I would bet, for Man City. I don't think it's even a question. And Pep Guardiola, by the way, is exactly the kind of strong manager that can rein Cristiano in, that he needs to really sort of, okay, look, don't stop standing wide on the left. You're not a left winger. You stand here and you make your runs when you and, you know, and what, obviously Pep's not going to tell Ronaldo where to stand to score goals, but he's going to tell Ronaldo where to stand when City don't have the ball, when City are out of position. He's going to tell Cristiano where to stand there to best be effective defensively and then be in position to spring into life and score goals. So it would have been perfect for him as a player and for City as a team. City would have, I mean, they would have swept everything. I would honestly, you know, it would have been ridiculous. So I can see why United panicked and bought him and ruined their plan, because it was like, no, we can't let that happen sort of thing. So I can see why they panicked, like, because it would have been absolutely perfect, because Cristiano, you know, everyone's on about this, oh, Cristiano doesn't, you know. And I mean, you know, I didn't like when United signed him for many reasons, but, you know, he's like Tom said, he's intelligent. He's a smart guy. He doesn't play, like, he's never played in a sort of really tactical system, so he's never really had to understand how smart he is. But you just look at the way he plays with Benzema, with Morata at Juventus. He understands space and how to use it very, very effectively. And part of the problems he has sometimes is that other players don't necessarily understand space as much. But he's a complicated figure, and, you know, he's time back in the Premier League. I mean, it'll be 2 years now. The only thing, my major criticism of it, though, I mean, other than the fact that it, you know, it's derailed Mason Greenwood completely. That's my only real major criticism, because you can't play the two of them together. Unless, of course, I suppose you're playing Ralph Rangnick's 4-2-2-2. Maybe that's the way. But I mean, until now, it's completely derailed Greenwood, who had 3 goals in 3 games before Ronaldo showed up, and then 1 goal in, like, I don't know, 10 or something after. That's my only real criticism of it. But with Rangnick, again, this is the thing. All we're talking about here is, it might all be moot with Ronaldo, because under Rangnick, it's going to be a coherent system of play, you'd expect. And maybe Greenwood and Ronaldo can play together. Then you're seeing Greenwood, Rashford, Ronaldo, the three of them rotate more in those two forward positions. Maybe it all really works now. Let's see. He needs a strong manager. Can Rangnick be that guy? Let's see.
If he'd have gone to City, he'd have linked up with Bernardo Silva, but he opted to go back to Old Trafford and link up with Bruno Fernandes. So Bernardo Silva is the next person we're going to touch on. And Tom, Mo's given us a disclaimer before we started recording that obviously Bernardo Silva and Diogo Jota are not the same player. They do play in different positions for City and for Liverpool. But in terms of some of the key stats, they almost run like for like alongside each other so far this season. So just going to give you a couple of the key numbers, Tom, before we get into assessing them in terms of performances. Diogo Jota, 8 Premier League goals, 3rd on the list at the moment, in behind Mo Salah and Jamie Vardy. Bernardo Silva's just behind him, 7 Premier League goals, from obviously from a deeper position. But for me, one of the interesting things is this idea of efficiency from being in those forward areas. So Bernardo Silva, as it stands, has got the highest ratio of shots to shots on target in the Premier League. 80% of his shots so far this season have tested the opposition goalkeeper. But then when you flip it across to Jota, and in terms of his role at Liverpool, just to make things even more complicated, 15 shots on target, and that has converted itself into those goals, those 8 goals. So he's averaging in and around almost a 50% goal rate based on his efforts that are going on target. Both of them in two similar but also separate ways have been absolutely fantastic. We'll start with Silva because obviously we're looking at this idea of the mini Portugal derby with Wolves and City this weekend. Bernardo Silva was in a position this summer where Pep Guardiola was open to the possibility of him potentially moving on from Manchester City. He didn't, he stayed, or a deal couldn't be agreed, however you want to frame it. And he's now, arguably, alongside Kevin De Bruyne, Manchester City's most important player. Is he now showing his level that he is one of the best in Europe? And these numbers and these stats that he's drawing in with this regularity are just underpinning that.
Yeah, I think he has been... you could argue that he has been one of the best in Europe previously. And even remember, I think it was 2 seasons ago where he had that fantastic season at Manchester City, and Pep Guardiola actually was just, you know, showering him with praise as he often does, you know, when his players are doing well. And I think even then he said that he thought that Bernardo Silva was their best player. I can't remember if it was 2 or 3 seasons ago at Manchester City.
It was 18-19, the season De Bruyne was injured.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Absolutely brilliant that season. And the season before, when he was at Monaco, you know, Monaco won the league against PSG. You know, I know Lille did it last year, but still a pretty amazing situation when anyone in France who isn't PSG wins the league. And especially, you know, did it with all those, you know, pretty young players. And Bernardo Silva was at the heart of it. What's different this season to previous seasons, those 2 previous seasons when he was really at the top of his game? I think it's goals. Isn't it? He's just scoring more goals now. He's never really been a prolific goal scorer. He's been actually more of a provider than a scorer himself. And this season, he's just added, you know, that facet to his game. He's just a fantastic all-round player. You know, he's a small guy. We all know but he just gets through an incredible amount of work. I think quite often at the end of games, he's the player who comes out top in the stats of, you know, who's run the most yards or the most meters in the game. Incredibly tenacious player, quite even aggressive in his own way, and, you know, really good at getting in blocks, robbing the ball off the opposition, but just so skillful and so you know, right from a young age, when he was at the Benfica academy, he had the nickname of a mini Messi. You know, I know there's probably about 100 players all over Europe who got that nickname, but that was his nickname at when he was in the Benfica youth system, because he was just so skillful. It was just when he got the ball on that left foot of his, it was just impossible to get it off him. And you see that, you know, going throughout his career. So, yeah, I think one thing for me, which really kind of exemplifies how brilliant that Bernardo Silva has been this season. I mean, you mentioned it there, Kevin De Bruyne, you know, widely considered probably the best midfielder in England the last 5 years or so. Gundogan, you know, look at the season he had last season. Absolutely incredible. Foden, you know, probably the best English player, most talented English players. Bernardo Silva's, you know, there's 3 players there basically in competing for Bernardo Silva in the midfield of Manchester City, and he's outshining them all. So, you know, incredible season. I think it's, he's just really fulfilling his potential, which a lot of people, when he first, you know, burst onto the scene, they said probably the most exciting Portuguese talent since Cristiano Ronaldo. And I think now he's just fulfilling that.
Yeah, Bernardo Silva's amazing. He's been great. Like the goals is a great point Tom points out. Like, his career best is 13 for Man City, which he got in that 18-19 season where City won the title. He got 9 the season before in his first season where he didn't play that much but still showed up every now and again. But what's amazing is the 13 goals he got those 13 in 51 games. Right now he has 7 goals in 20 games. So he's scoring at a higher rate than he was before. But it's not even the goals, because honestly, that's just incidental to me. What's made Bernardo so impressive, and why I say it's like hard to compare him to Jota. By the way, funny side note, both Bernardo and Jota have more goals than Cristiano Ronaldo. But anyway, What makes Bernardo just so impeccable is the way that he's helped City control games, whether he's playing false nine, central midfield, or he doesn't really play right wing that much this season, but the control he gives City in games, it's absolutely sensational. And you mentioned he's tenacious, Tom. Only João Cancelo, another Portuguese player, and Rodri have more tackles than him for City this season. He has 24.
Yeah.
Cancelo has 30, Rodri has 32. And it's funny because, you know, Pep Guardiola, we associate with Spanish football and Spanish players and this and that. But, and yeah, Rodri is huge. But it's funny because of Bernardo and João Cancelo are... He has three players basically responsible for giving him control of games, right? Two of them are Portuguese, one of them Spanish. It's just quite funny like that. Cancelo has been huge. We'll go to him in a minute. But Bernardo, what he gives City is just incredible control and the ability to take up the mini-Messi comparison. You know, no one is Messi, but you look at the way Bernardo can accelerate the ball by carrying it past two, three, four players. He had that amazing dribble at Anfield, didn't he? You know, so he has that ability to accelerate the game both with a pass and with a dribble. That's invaluable. Moreover, he's so tenacious that you can trust him to play central midfield in a 4-3-3. That's really rare for players of that type. That's Iniesta-esque. That's the comparison for me that I would consider for Bernardo Silva, not Messi, obviously, but Iniesta. Because if you look at him, he's a slight inside forward. You know, in most teams, he'd play winger in a 4-2-3-1, right? Or number 10 in a 4-2-3-1. He'd be the primary playmaker, right? But in his Pep system, he's a central midfielder and he adds so much because he can defend. He's much stronger and more tenacious than he looks. Very, very intelligent defensively. Pushes forward very well, presses very well, dribbles superbly. But unlike Iniesta, Bernardo Silva can actually shoot the ball. Iniesta, you know, for someone who's got two legendary goals, all-time legendary goals, really was not a good shot. But Bernardo Silva, to me, is the Premier League's Iniesta. We've always wanted one. We have one now. His name's Bernardo Silva, and he's sensational. And it's crazy that City were going to let him go in the summer, in as much as you thought it made sense at the time, given Jack Grealish's arrival. But, like, I mean, Bernardo's put Jack Grealish in the shade. Poor Captain Jack, man. He's, like, he's come in thinking he's going to be the big dog. And Bernardo's like, no.
No,
this is my yard. You can just sit and watch and learn the ropes, young man. And yeah, Bernardo Silva's been sensational. I mean, for me, the best player in the Premier League so far this season. Well, apart from, you know who, Mohamed Salah.
I want to ask you about Jota, Tom, in terms of his performances, because one of the biggest strengths or one of the biggest kind of feathers in Jota's cap for me is that title-winning teams, the strength, when we go back to Ferguson's days at Manchester United, was not being afraid to break them down and rebuild them, make the difficult decisions over, players being eased out or new players being brought in to strengthen things. Jurgen Klopp has kind of gone for a bit of a hybrid approach in terms of signings that he's made to strengthen very specific areas of the team. But by and large, the 11 that won the Premier League title for Liverpool in 2019 remains pretty much untouched. 8, 9 of that team are still absolute nailed on starters when fit. There's possibility over changeables for Van Dijk's partner at centre half. Obviously, Gini Wijnaldum has moved on to PSG. But Diogo Jota is the only one that has come in and essentially removed Roberto Firmino from the starting 11. Roberto Firmino was central to Liverpool winning the Champions League, winning the Premier League. And Diogo Jota has just usurped him from the starting 11. His performances have been that good. We rattled off his numbers just now in terms of goals and just the sheer efficiency of when a chance falls to him, it generally ends up in the back of the net. That, for me, is the biggest strength of Diogo Jota, that so many of those teams have been difficult to move out or replace or change. Diogo Jota has come in and gone, I'm this good. Jurgen, you can't not play me.
Yeah, I remember when the move was made, I was quite worried, really, to be honest. And I think a lot of Portuguese football fans were, that he was making the move from Wolves to Liverpool. You know, that front three has been such a kind of staple, hasn't it, for Liverpool for a number of years. And we all thought that this, you know, we could see Jota stalling quite a lot. And he'd spend a lot of time on the bench, maybe just get a few minutes at the end of games. But yeah, he's made a fantastic impact, and he really is the sort of player who just suits that, you know, the style of Jurgen of Klopp and the style of Liverpool. You know, this current Liverpool team is he just never stops. It's just such a runner. And I'm interested to hear you mentioning a few times the word efficiency there, because I must say, if there's one word which I don't associate with Jota, it's efficiency or clinical. Is that, you know, his I wouldn't call him a clinical finisher. I think he's so lively. He's got so much energy. He's good at taking up positions, and he's a little bit out of control sometimes. He just never stops running. That he always gets himself chances. But quite often he misses them. I remember seeing for Portugal, he's been terrible for the last 6 months. He's been terrible in the sense that he's played almost every game. He's been, I'd say, he's maybe had 20 goal-scoring chances in the last maybe 6 months. And I don't know how many goals he's scored, but maybe he's scored about four or five. It's just miss after miss after miss. But I think that would just, you know, that's something which I think he will improve on with age, you know, and with experience. I mean, we saw it last week, didn't we, against Wolves. It was quite hilarious that that miss, how he, again, just his tenaciousness and his energy, managed to get the ball, go past the goalkeeper, okay, basically had a whole goal to aim at, and he just absolutely blasted it at the, you know, one of the two defenders on the line, instead of just, you know, you can imagine someone like Mo Salah or Cristiano Ronaldo or any top-class goal scorer would have just, you know, picked his spot and rolled it into the net. So, yeah, he's the player who perfectly suits Liverpool's system, absolutely down to a T. And I think that's why he's been such a success. Those worries, which I talked about when he moved from Wolves to Liverpool, thankfully, they've been unfounded, because he's just been so good for them, that he's, you know, so perfect for that system, that he's, yeah, like you said, almost made himself undroppable, even pushed out Firmino quite a lot of the time. So, yeah, great footballer. I wouldn't call him clinical in my opinion, or efficient, but I'd just say the word which I think best exemplifies the way he plays is just energy. He's got so much energy that, like I say, he creates so many chances for himself. Doesn't perhaps, and you know, for a team like Liverpool, who just score goal after goal after goal, he's gonna get loads of goals for them.
Yeah, look, Jota, when Liverpool signed Mane, Mane wasn't this massively hyped prospect. He was a really talented player who had been brought through the Leipzig and Salzburg, the Ralf Rangnick Academy, basically. And so he had a lot of promise. And what Klopp did was he took this really, really promising player who was really good at Southampton as well, and made him into a world-class talent, right? Mohamed Salah always was world-class. He just needed a coach to push him on to that level and then beyond, which is why he's so good right now. Mane, and Jota to me is more like Mane. Like, he's not a world-class player, but he wasn't even maybe regarded as a world-class talent, but he had a lot of exactly what makes a great Jurgen Klopp kind of forward, which is exactly the same thing with Sadio Mane. Really, really good education, and he presses like a demon. He makes runs in behind. He's quick. He can dribble. And he shoots really, really well. He's erratic with his shooting, like Mane is. Mane can sometimes miss absolute cities. You're like, huh? How'd you miss that? But, you know, what makes him and Mane so good is they keep shooting. They keep going for it. They don't let it down. I mean, look at them this season in the Premier League. Salah's way out on his own, right, with a XG of 10.21 and an expected goals on target of 11.91, which, by the way, he's just shows how good he is at shooting.
That is wild.
His expected goals on target is even higher than expected goals, which means that he's so good at placing his shots that, anyway, yeah, just don't let him get a shot at goal, guys. If you want to stop, he's too good right now. But, you know, you look at Mane. Mane has an XG of 7.45 and expected goals on target of 6.15. Jota has expected goals of 7.91, so higher than Mane's, but on target 6.08, which reflects, I think, I mean, probably a big influence by that miss, but I think reflects the fact that he's a bit more erratic with his shot because he's younger than Mane, right? Mane's 30, Jota is 25. So, but I like Jota a lot, and I think he's really growing into his role in the Liverpool system. And I think ultimately what Liverpool will look to do is have him essentially replace Mane, and they'll sign an actual striker to go up front. I think that's what maybe the change I can see happening in time. Obviously, right now, Mane holds the spot. But I think Salah is the guy, right? Salah is the guy. He's world-class. He's the best player in that team. So you keep him there. But then right now he's replaced. He rotates with Firmino. Sometimes he plays left wing as well. So I think ultimately the goal will be put him in Mane's position and then sign a bomb centre forward to really just come in and lead the line. I don't know who that is. I mean, I'm sure they'd love Kylian Mbappe, but I think he's going to Madrid. So I don't know, maybe Erling Haaland? I mean, probably not, right? FSG are never going to pay his wages.
Yeah, I agree. I think my two pence on the Jota and Silva situation will be that I think Silva has done fantastically well this season. I think there's been a small bit of motivation over this idea in the summer that Pep, and he's doing it now with Raheem Sterling, was open to Silva moving on. I think there's a little bit of a point proven from Silva, or maybe even a little bit of deeper mind games from Pep to maybe get another level out of him. My point with Jota, why I'd probably just give him the edge, is this idea of a ceiling. On a basic level, he's got 2 years on Silva. Silva's 27 and he's 25. Playing in this Liverpool system, he's absolutely tailor-made for it, as Tom said before. And I just think, for me, in terms of what he can develop into, the things that we've mentioned as possible criticisms of Jota, maybe the odd erratic finish, maybe the odd high-profile miss, you can eke that out of your game. It doesn't take that long. And Jurgen Klopp has proven that with certain players. You can eke any little levels of inconsistency out. But the raw materials, Mo, as you said, that Diogo Jota has in his upbringing, in terms of his coaching background, is phenomenal. I think, honestly, he can just power on and power on and power on. I think his ability to go up a gear or two will govern the next stage of Liverpool's transfer business, because he is that good. It's not to take anything away from Bernardo Silva, but I think we're seeing the best Bernardo Silva now, whereas I think Jota still possibly, probably has another gear to go. And if he can kick those odd little misses out of his game, I think he could become one of the best strikers in the Premier League, but unfortunately probably still behind Mr. Salah. So anyway, right, we're going to move on to João Cancelo, Tom. Mo mentioned a couple of really interesting points before relating to his tackling stats and this idea of control. I think that's a really good point, because we're talking about a fullback who can play right back, he can play left back, and he's absolutely vital to, as Mo said, Manchester City gaining control of a game, despite the fact that he plays in a position that you wouldn't necessarily associate with that. And I think alongside the tackling stats, the two big ones are he is top for touches in the Premier League so far this season, 1,584, streets ahead of anyone else. Virgil van Dijk is second, and he's more than 300 behind him, which is a huge number when you look at it as a standalone position. But alongside that, he's also got huge stats for passes, 1,212. Again, van Dijk is second, and he's a good distance behind him. We're talking about a fullback that's got numbers that you'd expect from a dominant central midfielder. He's absolutely outgunned every other player in the league when it comes to the two criteria that you would associate with control. João Cancelo is a freak of nature.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it? It's interesting, this idea, which I think I agree with. I've read quite a few times over recent weeks and recent months even, that fullbacks are perhaps among the most important players in modern football, the way they play. And you can't really call Cancelo, I mean, everything you just said there, but you can't really call João Cancelo a fullback, can you, the way he plays? I mean, Pep's done exactly the same to him as he did at Kimmich, Lahm at Bayern, wasn't it? He's just basically redefined how he plays and his position on the pitch. And it's very interesting, because João Cancelo, you know, again, a player who's really, right from an early age, was expected to do great things. And it took him a while, really. You know, he's at Valencia, then he went to Inter, then he went to Juventus, and he had his moments at all of those clubs, but he never really consistently played at a very high level. And one criticism which was levelled at him, and I think rightly levelled at him, was his actual defending. You know, if he is a fullback, just a traditional fullback, I don't think he's the world's best defender. So, you know, but I don't think anyone realised until Pep got his hands on him, actually what he could do and what he could bring to a team coming forward. Absolutely amazing. Just completely redefined, like you said, the whole way he plays and almost that position. I remember, I think his first three games for Portugal, or if it wasn't his first three games, maybe if it was three of his first five games, he scored three goals. But he scored them just like, almost like a winger, just like, you know, bombing down the wing, cutting inside and then smashing it in from an angle. And you know, people were very excited about that. But then his defending was so bad at times, and he also had some injury problems, that he never really nailed down that place in Portugal's, you know, first team, Portugal's, you know, first choice team until relatively recently. And of course, unfortunately for Portugal, I think it was a very big explanation for why they did so badly at Euro 2020. Also, he missed that because of COVID. And but you know, he's just completely changed, like you said, completely changed the whole definition of a fullback. Is just like a roaming kind of wing back, midfielder. Well, I don't know what you want to call him, but yeah, is again, it's I think the mark of just a genius of a manager, isn't it? Pep Guardiola, he manages to take these brilliant players who've got brilliant raw materials, Bernardo Silva, João Cancelo, and he just when you think that these players can't really perform any better, he actually takes them up a notch or two, and they're doing things which you just, you know, just unbelievable to see. So
I mean, João Cancelo came to City as part of a Danilo deal. Like he it was like, yeah, we've signed a backup right back for Kyle Walker. He was a flying wing back. This, like Tom says, he scored. He was for years. He looked at him. He thought, fantastic athlete, great shot on him. But my God, he's an idiot. You know, you look at him, you think this guy's dumb as a bag.
Yeah,
he's dumb as a bag of hammers. This guy is used, you know. And then he goes to City, and you're thinking this is going to be a disaster. He's a phenomenal natural athlete. Okay, fine, but like he's not going to get. And you know, for a year or so, he didn't look like he got it at all. He was playing right back behind Walker. He'd come in and look much better than Walker in attack, but then he would be obviously rubbish in defence. And then Pep Guardiola, man, he's the best coach in the world. He turned this guy into a left back, and you say that he has the stats of a midfielder because he's playing midfield, dude. You look at the way City's left back functions, he just comes into midfield. And then whoever's playing left midfield then basically plays like a winger or a forward. And that City's system is the underlapping fullback. So he did it with both of them previously at Bayern sometimes, when he had Alaba and Alarm just play midfield next to Toni Kroos. And then that way he could just fill the team with attacking midfielders and wingers. And it was just ridiculous. And, you know, even at Barcelona, man, Dani Alves, you know, he had Dani Alves do this and Alves was the pioneer of that. I mean, Alves was doing that at Sevilla, you know, before Pep. And then he came to play with Pep, and it was like, you know, two geniuses meeting, and it was like it became even better. Like Alves was the best right back of all time, right? Phenomenal player. And so, you know, these guys, Trent and João Cancelo especially, are in his mold, are in Alves' mold. Even Reece James to a degree. I mean, Reece James played midfield in the Champions League against Zenit. So these guys are all in Dani Alves' mode. They're all following in his footsteps, right? And Marcelo to a degree, but even he was following in Dani Alves' footsteps. And, you know, Cancelo's phenomenal. He's incredible. He offers so much control to City. Like I said, the three guys that control games for City, two of them Portuguese, Bernardo Silva and João Cancelo. And you know, it's weird because obviously you wouldn't say that Trent isn't the best right back in the Premier League, but is he the best fullback? Because honestly, I think João Cancelo might doesn't produce like Trent does. Of course he doesn't. Trent is a production machine. But again, in terms of how does City win games? They win games through control, possession, pressing, passing, dominating the opponent, pushing them back, suffocating them. And João Cancelo is a key part of that. So he's as key to City's dominance as Trent and his assists are to Liverpool's. And they are, for me, 1A and 1B fullbacks in not just the Premier League, but in the world.
Just to add another layer to the Cancelo loving, just checking some of his other stats here. He can tackle, he can pass, he can control games. He can also shoot. He's got 12 shots on target in the Premier League so far this season, which is level with Silva and more than 50% more than any other defender, not just fullback, any other defender in the Premier League. So João Cancelo really can do everything. Just looking at some of the other names, Tom, we've talked about some of the main names, Jota, Silva, Ronaldo and Cancelo, but there's 17 Portuguese internationals currently playing in the Premier League, more than at any other time in Premier League history. It really is a golden age for Portuguese players in the Premier League. So I just wanted to ask you about some of the others that maybe have slipped under the radar a tiny bit. We have Ruben Dias, who's the reigning PFA Player of the Year based on fantastic campaign with Manchester City last season. Bruno Fernandes, I can't believe we've barely mentioned him so far this season, because at Manchester United, there is so much attention on Cristiano Ronaldo, but 5 Premier League goals in 15 games, 3 Premier League assists tucked in with that as well. We still have the ever-present Portuguese contingent at Wolves, Ruben Neves, Yao Moutinho, Francisco Trincão. Who, for you, alongside the big names, should we be looking at in the Premier League and saying they're in the conversation, there or thereabouts, to be the best Portuguese player in the Premier League?
Yeah, well, I'll give you a couple of names. I think one of them, people have slightly forgotten about him because he's just had such a a bad time with injuries recently. But Ricardo Pereira at Leicester City, fantastic. Again, wing back, right back. That's also another reason why João Cancelo didn't always get in the Portugal team, because sometimes Ricardo Pereira was picked ahead of him. But absolutely brilliant player. Pereira, again, I'd say Portugal have been blessed with, some fantastic, potentially, wing-backs, unfortunately. Fernando Santos doesn't play with that system, although Portugal, seem to be absolutely perfectly set for that. But anyway, that's a different story. But I'd say just in terms of defending, I'd say Ricardo Pereira is probably Portugal's strongest right-back, full-back even. Absolutely fantastic player. He's actually a winger. He started off as a winger at Vitória de Guimarães, then he went on to Porto, and then he was converted to a fullback. But again, great player. He's kind of 8 out of 10, 9 out of 10 performance every single week. Maybe not as eye-catching, certainly not as eye-catching as well Cancelo, the way Cancelo's playing this season. But, really strong performer, and I'm really just hoping he he's had a really bad time with injuries last couple of seasons. I kind of, dragged him back, because before then, I think a lot of people were kind of considering him as possibly the best right back in the Premier League. I think it was before, Trent kind of took his game to a different level. He was certainly being talked about in those kind of terms. So hopefully he'll get back to full speed. And then another player who, again, has been a little bit, his progress has been halted by injury, unfortunately, but a player who I think could turn into a real world-class winger is Pedro Neto at Wolves. Again, I think he was probably lined up to win Young Player of the Season last season at Wolves before he got that really bad injury, still recovering from it now, an ACL injury. But, he's so Portugal traditionally, of course, have produced fantastic wingers, going right back to Paulo Futre, Figo, Ronaldo himself, of course, Nani. And Pedro Neto just seemed to be, kind of following up that tradition. He, is progressing really nicely at Wolves. I think he scored 10 goals by about January or February before that injury. And so, and that was when Nuno was at Wolves, who, as we all know, is certainly wasn't the most attacking manager. So probably made it even more difficult for him. And it's also a player who really Portugal are missing now, because I just mentioned those fantastic wingers they used to produce, seemingly on a kind of conveyor belt, but that has stopped, that's halted, and they really miss a player like him. So I think if those two get back up to full speed, maybe in 1 year's time, if we have a similar kind of podcast talking about the best Portuguese in the Premier League, I think those two would probably be high up on the list.
Violins that for Bruno Fernandes, though, guys, come on. Because we aren't discussing him, and that's absurd, because he has been quite poor since Ronaldo has rocked up to the Premier League. We'll discuss more on that in a second. But look, since his debut in the Premier League, right, in January 2020 or February 2020 technically, 53 goals and assists combined, right? Only Mohamed Salah has more than that, 60 goals and assists combined. That's only because of his amazing season this season, when Fernandes has struggled, right? He's absolutely sensational. He's been incredible. He was the best player in the Premier. Like I said, up until the international break at the start of the season, three games into the season, from his debut to that point, he was the best player in the Premier League. Easily.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to argue with you at all if you big up Bruno Fernandes. Probably one of my favourite players. I'm a Sporting fan. I watch them every week, all their home games. And so I watch Bruno Fernandes every other week for three seasons. And I just could not believe that he stayed at Sporting for as long as he did, because everything he's done at Manchester United, he was doing at Sporting. Mm. Incredible player, like you said, a midfielder just putting up numbers which a striker would be proud of. And absolutely brilliant.
It's not just the numbers, though. It's not just the numbers. It's the influence. Because look, what Fernandes has done is really sort of highlighted how disappointing Paul Pogba has been. And before I was always, before Fernandes, I was thinking Pogba's been okay. He's not been great, but he's been good. He's been had moments of greatness. He's been let down by his coaches, blah, 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 blah. And that's all true. None of that is a lie. But Fernandes comes in into the same situation Pogba's in. And instead of being mired in the nonsense like Pogba is, like you said, he's reproducing his Portugal numbers in the Premier League. He was like, yeah, I don't care these people are. And he grabbed United by the scruff of the neck, and almost single-handedly, I mean, Marcus Rashford had a huge hit saying it as well. So it's those two, really. But along with Marcus Rashford, dragged United into being a relevant team again. United were not a relevant team before he showed up. This is the funny thing about Solskjaer and everyone sort of misremembering. United, before Bruno Fernandes, United's whole vibe was they would sit deep, hit teams on the break, and they could produce big game moments with that, big game performances with 3-5-2, playing on the break with Rashford and whatnot, and Dan James, and it was good, it was fine. They weren't a consistent team, they weren't playing well. Bruno Fernandes comes along, and suddenly United are actually good again. United are actually really good again. They can win games consistently. They can beat opponents they're meant to beat. They put up big numbers. They went on two Europa League runs. They should have won the Europa League both of those seasons, but Victor Lindelof decided to, Victor Lindelof it and let the opponents score easy goals. And then David De Gea debased himself in that penalty shootout. But, Bruno Fernandes is absolutely incredible. He's sensational. He's so good, by the way, that Villarreal's entire game plan in the Europa League final was, okay, we're just going to mark him and then we're going to dare the rest of you to beat us. And they did that and no one else could stand up and beat it because, he was man-marked. No one knew what to do without Bruno Fernandes. He's been incredible. He's really suffered since Cristiano Ronaldo has arrived in the team because, as Tom hinted at earlier, they don't have good chemistry because essentially they do the same thing. And each of them need a different player to the other one. Like they're like the Lampard and Gerrard of Portugal, but they're midfielder and forward. It doesn't sound right, but they can't play together. Not at their best anyway.
Just want to look at the international picture for Portugal before we wrap up, Tom, because we now know that in terms of qualification for the 2022 World Cup, that either Portugal or Italy are not going to make it. They've gone into Pat C of the playoff bracket. Portugal have Turkey, Italy have North Macedonia. If they both get through that, then they'll essentially have a playoff for a place, which means that either the 2016 winners in Portugal won't qualify or the defending European champions won't reach the World Cup. So in terms of the picture, obviously Cristiano Ronaldo is a big factor in that. He's 36, he'll be 37 going into the World Cup next year. Looking further down the line to Euro 2024, he'll be 39. And obviously with Ronaldo, you can't rule anything out. He does manage to kind of stop the clock on his aging. So you wouldn't necessarily say that he wouldn't play at Euro 2024. But Portugal have missed chances to seal an automatic qualification position. They ran headfirst into the Stephen Kenny Boys in Green revolution and then lost to Serbia in the final game to make sure they couldn't reach the World Cup. This is disappointing. The amount of talent, we've been waxing lyrical about them during the podcast that Fernando Santos has at his disposal, but they've messed it up. They should be at the World Cup. They should have qualified automatically, but they couldn't get past Ireland. They couldn't get past Serbia. And now they're in a position where it's essentially a toss of a coin whether or not Ronaldo gets a final hurrah on the world stage.
Yeah, it's right. People in Portugal, they're really furious with the coach. It's basically people have put it all down on the coach, and I think fairly, to be honest. Fernando Santos will always be a national hero in Portugal because he won Euro 2016, of course, which was Portugal's first ever major trophy. But he's kind of been, living off that, or the glory of that, ever since. And of course, the way Portugal won that trophy was a way which really doesn't play in the kind of football which doesn't suit the players they have at this moment. I think Fernando Santos, he did well at Euro 2016 because he had a lot of players who suited his system, which is very conservative kind of football, just basically making sure you keep it really tight. And then you've got so much talent up front, basically Cristiano Ronaldo, that you can try and nick a goal and you can beat anyone. And that's what Portugal did, almost winning, taking just full advantage of that very set game plan and going all the way and lifting the trophy. The thing is, at the moment, we've been talking about it now, you ask anyone in Portugal, let's say this team or the team which was at Euro 2020, which was played this last summer, or, this next World Cup, is without a question much more talented, packed with much more talented players than the team which won Euro 2016. And so the problem was, this isn't a team at the moment. This coach has absolutely proven again and again that he seems to have no idea how to get the best out of this player, out of this squad, how to find the right chemistry, basically. Also, another slight problem Portugal have got, they've got some of the, a whole list of amazing players. We've talked about some of them here, Bruno Fernandes, Bernardo Silva, can also talk about João Félix at Atletico Madrid, but they're quite kind of similar players and they even occupy kind of similar positions on the pitch. So Mo just mentioned there the, you know, the famous Lampard-Gerrard conundrum, which just seemed to rumble on for about a decade, didn't it? Well, in Portugal, we've got exactly the same kind of question here with Bruno Fernandes and Bernardo Silva, because it's very rare for them to play together well for Portugal, you know, or quite often actually in recent games, even Bruno Fernandes, you know, who we were just talking about, has been absolutely incredible for about 5 or 6 years solid for his club side, just really hasn't produced at all for Portugal. And Bernardo Silva has, on and off, on and off, not at the same level he is at Manchester City, but he has been better. And for instance, the game against Serbia, again, he was practically the only Portugal player who put in a good performance. So, yeah, I mean, it's just a crying shame for Portuguese, all these Portuguese players, for Ronaldo, of course, himself, if they don't make it to the World Cup. And it's, you know, it's just a shame in the sense that it's a pity that, you know, Ronaldo doesn't get his last hurrah. But it's also shame in the sense that it's shameful and or a disgrace, as Portuguese fans would say, that how can we have such a talented squad of players, you know, and not be at the World Cup, where, you know, you would have thought if they had a good manager or a manager who knew how to get the best out of his talents, not only would Portugal be at the World Cup, you'd have to say they were contenders to, you know, get very far in the World Cup.
Yeah, Fernando, it's all on Fernando Santos. And I mean, even Euro 2016, that wasn't a good performance by Portugal in that tournament. They finished third in a group that had Hungary in it. They just about got through because they expanded the tournament. They drew all three of the games, didn't win a single game, group stage game. Then they brought Jose Font into penance to Pepe, and they stiffened up at the back, and then they sort of ground out some wins, right? They got 1-0, I think, in the with Quaresma in the extra time against Poland, right?
Is that correct?
And then they beat Wales, and Renato Sanchez really would grind games out. They'd be boring as hell. Renato Sanchez would come on, inject a bit of life into the game, and they'd find a goal from somewhere. Right, that's what they did. Rinse, repeat for the whole tournament. In the final, Eder comes out with that. So it wasn't a repeatable performance, right? That wasn't a blueprint to play well. Game after tournament after tournament. France have a much better squad than Portugal. France tried the same thing. They've won the World Cup essentially doing the bare minimum defensively and just overwhelming teams in attack, and tried to repeat that again. It doesn't work because you can't play the percentages that low, that thin every time. Eventually, you have to try and win games offensively or you're going to come up cropper. England tried it 2 tournaments in a row, play the percentages, and eventually you come up short. Italy played the percentages Euro 2020, worked out. Nations League didn't work out so much because you have to eventually try and win games. And Portugal have one of the best squads in the world. With a better coach, they would be phenomenal. Cristiano Ronaldo is a bigger problem for Portugal, I think, than he is for Man United, which is weird because obviously he's literally the greatest goal scorer in the history of the country, the greatest player in the history of the country. He's phenomenal. But because Portugal don't have a Benzema and they also don't have a man, it may be with a stronger manager, it would be different, but with the manager they have right now, they could play a great team even without him. You take him out of there, you have Andre Silva as a striker, number 9, you've got Bernardo Silva playing on the wing, you've got João Félix, maybe it's a square peg in a round hole in that team, but you've got Bernardo Silva, Diogo Jota, you play them wide, you play Bruno Fernandes, William Carvalho maybe, Ruben Neves, you've got so much talent, Renato Sanchez, there's so much talent in that team that there's just no way that team should be as poor as they are. And I mean, part of it is Fernando Santos. Part of it is the fact that he doesn't have the courage. Part of it is Cristiano is too good to drop, but not good enough to play in a cohesive system, if that makes any sense. Like, you can't drop him because he's Ronaldo and he scores goals for fun. Like, he's more goals than anyone in international football history. But at the same time, you kind of should drop him. It's a really tough decision, and you just wonder who's going to have the guts to make it. It's the kind of thing like when Spain dropped Raul, it's a more exaggerated version of that. When Luis Aragonés said, all right, you know what, we need to build a new team, off you go, Raul. And Raul was the greatest striker in Spain's history at the time, legendary figure, and Luis Aragonés dropped him. And everyone gave Luis Aragonés loads of abuse for that, but he was like, no, we're building a team. In, you know, it's a young team and build it around David Villa, around Fernando Torres, around Xavi. And, you know, I'm not saying that Portugal have the next Spain, but you can see the building blocks of a great side there if a manager takes the tough call and drops the greatest goal scorer in the country's history. which is not to say that the goal scorer is necessarily deficient. By the way, for the playoffs, though, no Doherty for the playoffs. He loves World Cup playoffs. Remember Sweden? He loves World Cup playoffs. But maybe after this World Cup, I mean, I would drop him before, but maybe after this World Cup, you say, all right, this is your last hurrah, Cristiano. You can have your last shot at the World Cup. Because I think they'll get it past Italy in the World Cup. I think Ronaldo dominates Italian opposition in the Champions League. Every time he's faced Bonucci and Chiellini, he's given them hell. Portugal will have maybe Italy will do it. Maybe. But I'd be surprised if Ronaldo didn't just find a way to pull it out of the bag just to get Portugal over the line and go to the World Cup. Yeah, he loves a bit of drama. That would be very dramatic. But if I'm Portugal, I would say this is your last shot, mate. After this World Cup, for the Euro 2024, you're out of the team. I know he's really good and he's the greatest goal scorer of all time, country's greatest goal scorer, but they need to start building for the future. They've got such an amazing team in there, just waiting to come out. They just need to get rid of Cristiano and it will happen.
Brilliant stuff, guys. Thanks so much for your time. And we are going to call it there for this week's edition of the Squawker Talker podcast. As always, if you're a fan of the podcast, if you click subscribe up the top there, you can get access to the brand new episode as soon as it is ready. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you again very, very soon.